Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Before we hear the good news about bike sharing around the world, let's finish up with that amazing new research led by Dr. Julie Brigham-Grett of the University of Massachusetts. She's been studying a meteor impact lake on the eastern tip of Siberia. I'm playing you selections from a YouTube video uploaded July 2012.
Let's look at another one here. This now is in the center of this long stack from 3.6 million down to the present. And here we're looking at an event at 1.1 million called Marine Isotope Stage 31. We highlighted this because we knew from the Anduril record in Antarctica that during this time, this was the last well-documented time when the West Antarctic ice sheet had disappeared. So we wanted to say, well, what happened in the Arctic at the same time? What happened at the other end, at the other polar region? So we went in and looked at that particularly warm interval. And here again is a similar diagram, the paleomagnetic stack, and take this tiny interval here and expand it out. We looked at the pollen again, looked at the biome data, and again we got summer temperatures that are in excess of 6 or 7 degrees warmer than present. Not quite as warm as stage 11, but certainly much warmer than present during this time. So what can we gather from stage 31? Why was it warmer? What was driving that? It's very difficult. Once we go beyond the Epica ice cores, back beyond 800,000 years ago, we don't have a direct measure of CO2. So other scientists like Panusha here at Lamont Doherty has produced a paper where she suggested in stage 31 that the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may have been in the range of 300 to 325. There's some error bars on those estimates. So it's possible that the carbon dioxide of the atmosphere was warmer during this particular time. We would expect a normal interglacial level to be about 280 parts per mil. So this is a little warmer, a little higher than what we would expect. If we look at from the southern hemisphere to the equator to the northern hemisphere here, we can also see that due to the changes in the Earth's orbit, the orbit around the sun, the tilt of the Earth, and the season in which we're closest to the sun, those influence also the energy coming into the upper atmosphere. And we can see that, in fact, during this stage 31, that, in fact, we were getting about 50 watts per meter squared greater input from the sun at that time. So we could see that there was a Milankovitch, shall we say, or orbital forcing part to this. So we wanted to then say, well, how does that link with Antarctica here? But I want you to notice that, look, there's several places here going back, and there's this M2 interval is at 3.2 million, when there are other times when the West Antarctic ice sheet disappeared. Now, this was an amazing accomplishment for Anduril to be able to demonstrate that the West Antarctic ice sheet was not a stable phenomenon, that, in fact, it is vulnerable and able to come and go. Let me bring that back to Lake Elgigikki now. This diagram is simply our proxy going back from 0 to 2.8 million. And if we zero in on this one, this is stage 31, stage 11, the last interglacial here, and the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, comparing these four different warm periods. What I want to bring your attention to is this diagram shows changes in vegetation, but down here is a biome reconstruction of the July temperature for these four different interglacials, and we're living in this one right now. And then this is also mean annual precipitation. And what I want mainly to see here is that both isotope stage 31 and 11 were much warmer and much wetter than anything we've seen in the Arctic before. This is an absolutely unprecedented record. We didn't expect it, and it certainly was a big surprise for us to see this, but it certainly seems to be holding up really well. So what it means is that Greenland is not only just this ice sheet that sits there no matter what the North Atlantic does. In fact, probably comes and goes and has come and gone much more frequently than any of us had imagined. Now, stage 11 and 31 are not isolated. There are other, what we're calling super interglacials in the Lake Elgigikki record. So with that, I want to end by summarizing, first of all, that the Elgigikki record is offering us a glimpse for the very first time in one location. Lots of surprises. The first of all being that we have extreme warmth many, many times throughout the last few million years. And this extreme warmth has major implications probably for the stability of the Greenland ice sheet and also for the sea ice history of the Arctic. That, in fact, it may be much easier to get rid of that sea ice than we thought before.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions or comments?
So in stage 31 at 1.1 million, yes, we see dark coniferous forests come back to the lake.
But is it there now?
Because no.
Because the carbon dioxide is the same, you said, right?
No, but it's, let's say it's coming. I mean, if you look at all across the north, tree line is marching north. The shrub tundra is starting to move into the open tundra regions. Even though we're at approaching 400 parts per mil now, the Earth system has to catch up. Richard Alley has said this before that, hey, Greenland is still thinking decades ago. Greenland hasn't even caught up to where we are now. And so the transition to actually see the vegetation move will take many, many decades.
That was University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor Julie Brigham-Grett presenting results from research at Lake Elgigigitin on the eastern tip of Siberia in the Russian Arctic. Search for her video on YouTube or find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Now we know the world will never be the same. Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around, get on your bike, sit on the seat.
Quick quiz, what way of getting around is growing faster than any mode of transport in the history of the planet? If you said cars, motorbikes, or skateboards, no. The right answer is bike sharing. It's almost enough to give us hope. Here to brighten our day with news about the wave of carbon-friendly bicycle travel around the world is Janet Larson. She's the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. Janet, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, before we get to that sharing part, is there anywhere in modern cities to use these bikes safely without being run down by cars?
Oh, certainly. I think cities around the globe are trying to figure out how to make the bicycle a more integrated part of their transportation schemes. And to do that, that means increasing bicycle lanes, increasing bicycle paths, having separated cycle tracks alongside traffic but separated by bollards or permanent cones so that cyclists can cycle in comfort and know they have a part of the road, which cyclists have always asked cars to share the road, and now cities are trying to make it even easier for them to do so.
I was always in love with a setup in Amsterdam where they have separate bike paths that aren't part of the sidewalk. They aren't part of the roads. They're like just separate little paths that run right through the city.
Exactly. Amsterdam has long been a cycling leader. Copenhagen is another city people point to where the traffic lights are timed in what they call a green wave so that at a normal cycling speed, you can go through intersection after intersection after intersection, always hitting a green light while you ride along the separated safe cycle track. So it's very exciting what a number of European cities are doing to make it easier for people to get around on two wheels. And right now in Copenhagen, over 35% of trips are made on bicycles. I think Amsterdam's even slightly higher. So it's clearly it's working.
Right. I've been to Amsterdam and I've looked down the main streets of the city at 9:30 in the morning, for example. You hardly see a car. Everybody's using the transit and they're using their bikes. Well, there's plenty of bike action in North America and we will get to that. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about Copenhagen, what their plan was. And I heard that they've shut it down after 17 years. What's going to replace it? Talk to us about that, would you?
Well, Amsterdam sort of kicked off the bike-sharing universe. Back in the 60s, there was a group that left 50-some bicyclists in various parts of the city scattered around. They were painted bright white. Copenhagen took off after that, and in several Danish cities along with Copenhagen, they had bicycles where they were placed around the city. Some were for free. Some had a system where you could put in a coin, not very much money at all, and check out a bicycle, return it to another dock. And in Copenhagen, that it's called Bicyclen, which means city bike, and they had over 1,000 bicycles on the street for 17 years, and just in the end of 2012, they shut down that program. Then there was an announcement that it would not be replaced right away because the city was having trouble getting funding, and the outroar was enormous. And so City Hall had to backpedal. And now there are planning to get a modern system on the streets this year, we hope. And when I say a modern bike sharing system, instead of a coin deposit system, it would be based probably on a smart card or smart lock technology where people can sign up with a membership, usually using a credit card, and you get your own code or your membership key, and you can use that to check in and out bicycles. And that's a way to generally cut down on the number of bikes that are stolen, disappeared, vandaled, because it's associated with your membership card. So that's how Copenhagen's ready to move forward into the next generation of bike sharing.
That was a problem. I remember with those white bikes in Amsterdam, they were pretty ugly, they were pretty basic, and they worked great, but people loaded them up in trucks and sold them off in Eastern Europe. You mentioned in your release that there's also ways that they could put special parts that can't be replaced or other ways to avoid this problem of bike stealing.
Exactly. As bike sharing has evolved, it's gone from just painting bikes colors, which then could easily be repainted and sold on the black market, or they put on container ships and ending up in Africa or anywhere in the world. Now, the new ones, generally, new programs opening up have pretty distinctive-looking bikes. The parts are unique to those bikes so that you can't just take your regular old tools and disassemble it and then use those parts on any other bike. So they have very little value except in the system. That's the way that most of the city's opening new programs are going now.
And what's happening with bike sharing in France?
Well, France is interesting because France does not have that same kind of long-held cycling culture that the Netherlands or Denmark has, where people just use bikes to get around day to day. In France, the car is in most of the cities is much more prevalent, but it was France that ushered the world into we call this modern era of bike sharing. In 1998, when the advertising company Clear Channel opened the world's first public computerized bike program with 200 bikes in the city of Rennes. And then in 2005, France's third largest city, Lyon, opened a program called Vélov that had 1,500 bikes at 100 automated self-service docking stations. And Lyon's program was enormously successful. Just within the first year, the city saw bicycle ridership increase 44%. And the program was deemed to be a success about getting people out of the cars. You'd see the bikes everywhere around Lyon. And that led to the opening of possibly the world's most well-known bike-sharing program, Vélib, in Paris, which opened in 2007. And Vélib has been incredibly popular among Parisians and tourists alike. Vélib opened in 2007 with 10,000 bicycles and very quickly doubled. They now have over 2,000 bikes in their fleet. And this was an innovative program. It was the city of Paris entered into a 10-year contract with the advertising firm JC Deco. JC Deco would be in charge of getting the bikes on the street and operating the program, maintaining it, in exchange for street-side advertising space so they could put up billboards for their clients around the city in exchange for running this program for the city. And since 2007, there have been over 130 million trips on the Vélib bicycles. People come back from Paris and say, the bikes were everywhere. And 10 years ago, people really weren't biking around Paris that much. But now people have joined the program, realize it's possible to get to and from their workplaces or the cafe on a bicycle. And it's just really changed the culture overall. You know, still, city acknowledges there's room to grow. Bicycling had been about less than a 1% share of all trips before the Vélib opened, and now it's about 3% of all trips. So it's a great growth, but Paris realizes it can go farther. And its current mayor, Bertrand Delanoë, he is a huge champion of bicycles. In fact, he said that the automobile no longer has a place in the big city of our times. And so he's moving forward, developing new bike lanes and paths. They're going to have 700 kilometers of bike lanes by the end of next year. and they've reduced speed limits in the inner part of the city, making it much more friendly for people to bike around without worrying about getting hit by a car. There's dedicated bus lanes so that buses can move around more efficiently as well. And the bike sharing system really complements that bus, the subway, the mass transit, because it solves what transportation planners call the first mile and the last mile problem. You can jump on a bike, get yourself to a bus station or a train station, ride the bus or train to your place of work or as close to it as you can get, and then you can hop on another bike if you have to travel another mile or so to get to your office. So people have had great luck doing it, and you don't have to dress yourself in spandex and lycra to do it. People are doing it in high heels with their fancy purses and scarves, and it's really revolutionized Parisian transport.
I just love hearing about this. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the new bicycle revolution. Well, there's another aspect to this, and I'm thinking about the country of Spain. Now, they're going through tremendous economic difficulties at the time, very high unemployment, about 26%. It's over 50% for young people there, and bicycles are a much better way to get around. So in a way, if you can develop your bicycle transport system, you're also developing resiliency for difficult times and helping the people who need it the most.
That's a great point. The bike is, you know, once you have a bike, there's no gasoline to fuel it with. The operating costs are very small. Repairs are far, you know, you could buy a new bike for what a typical auto repair would cost if you needed to. And then the bike sharing system is just another way if to even get around ownership of a bicycle. Somebody else is maintaining it. Somebody else is pumping up the tires. You just pay a relatively modest annual membership fee, and then you have access. You're able to get around. So if you're job hunting, looking for a job, you can use the bike to get there. So it's great for young people who might not have a driver's license or anybody who can't afford a car, and then more generally people who decide they don't want to be burdened by a personal automobile that they then have to figure out where to park and take care of. So the bike sharing is really great, particularly for these dense cities and then our urbanizing world as a whole.
I run into a lot of young people who tell me, there's just no way I can afford a car right now. And even if I could, I'd rather spend the money on lattes and other things, you know, or pay for the new house that I want. So they're just not buying a car. They're not getting a driver's license. And the bike is the way they're going. I think that's progress.
Oh, I think so, definitely. It used to be sort of a rite of passage. You get your car and then you go out and cruise the boulevard. And that's how you meet up with your friends. And today, you know, there's smartphones, there's the internet. That's how people are socializing. People are busy. They want to make the most of their commuting time. So if you can, you know, hop on a bike, then get to a metro system where then you can sit in the metro and read your iPhone or your iPad and then jump off and get on another bike and get where you need to go. You don't have to waste time behind the wheel. And it's freeing. It's also, it increases, I think, the well-being and the feeling of connection with a community when you're on a bike versus a car. You often are going slower, although I guess I must say in cities that are plagued by congestion, oftentimes you can get where you need to go faster in a bike than you can in a car. But you're looking around at your surroundings. I bike from my home in Northeast Washington, D.C. to my office in Northwest Washington, D.C. And when I'm stopped at a light, you know, you chat with the other cyclists next to you and say good morning. And it just really increases the social fabric of a community. It's just such a more human scale thing than to be trapped inside your car.
Out of the boxes and into the peoplescape. Janet Larson, lay some statistics on us. How many cities have bike sharing projects? How many bikes? How fast is it growing?
Well, this was something that really surprised us when we at Earth Policy Institute, we tried to track the number of cities and countries with bike sharing programs. And it seems like every week there's new cities and programs being added, but worldwide there's almost 49 countries now with advanced bike sharing programs, more than 500 cities, and the combined fleet is over 500,000 bicycles. It's growing faster than any other form of transportation in human history. It's really started in Europe, but now that that is spreading, and North America is finally getting on board. Our number of programs in the United States is set to double within the next year or two.
I'm going to be asking you about specific parts of the United States, but before we get there, I want to ask, is this just a fad among richer countries? What is happening in Mexico, for example, or in Asia?
Oh, well, so start with Latin America. Mexico City opened a bike sharing program a few years ago, and when they did, they quickly had to establish a wait list because they got more membership requests than they thought the system could accommodate. Mexico City, if you've been there, you know that the traffic is just horrendous. It's hard to imagine being on a bicycle there, but the city now is working to try to have its bicycle infrastructure match the interest of in cycling. They have a famous event on Sundays in Mexico City where a lot of the major streets are shut down to cars, and you get 15,000 or more people out on bicycles, families, young people, old people out on the cycles, enjoying the sight, enjoying the streets. So I think they're really trying to boost the culture there, and the bike share is just a part of it. In several other Latin American countries, I think there's a dozen or so programs in Latin America. Brazil has a few programs, including in Sao Paulo, where there's actually two separate companies that have established bike share. Colombia has a program. Quito, Ecuador has one. But if you want to see where bike share is really booming, you look at Asia. The biggest program in the world now is in Wuhan, China, that has a city of 9 million people, and they have 90,000 shared bikes in their bike share system. It's enormous. The second largest one is in Hangzhou, which has almost 70,000 bicycles in its scheme, and you see them everywhere. You know, China has long been known as the bicycle kingdom. It's the world's leading bicycle manufacturer and exporter. You picture Chinese cities on the bike, but in recent decades, the car had really taken over, and I think these bike sharing schemes are the city planners and the people's way of saying, you know, wait, give us back our two wheels. Let us get around better, because they realize that in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, people were just spending hours stuck behind the wheel in a traffic jam and not getting anywhere they needed to go. So combining some of their new bus rapid transit systems with fast-moving buses with bike sharing systems, I think, is the way to go, and China is going gangbusters.
Yeah, it makes me sad to think about what happened in China. In the early 1990s, we saw that video of throngs of commuters filling the streets, biking into work, and it had to be so healthy for the people. Now, you hardly want to breathe the air because the same polluting car culture from America and pushed by the same car companies like General Motors has kind of filled up the Chinese streets. Well, as you say, they've got a history of the bike culture, and I'm hoping that they can turn it around and bring it back. It's going to be better for everybody and for the climate. And you mentioned New York. Is there anything else exciting happening there for bike culture?
Yes. New York City will be rolling out in May, most likely, what will become the biggest bike sharing system in the United States. They ultimately want to get up to 10,000 bicycles citywide, if not larger, but they'll start with a smaller rollout of about just over 5,000 bikes this spring. And they opened up their registration for memberships just the other week, and within 24 or 30 hours, they had 5,000 people sign up for these bikes and are not even available yet. So there's huge pent-up demand in New York City for this bike-sharing program. And over the last few years, Mayor Bloomberg has done a lot to extend New York's bike lane network as well. So it's getting much easier to ride around the city on a bicycle, and riders will soon be able to do it on these bikes. New York system is called City Bike. It's sponsored by Citibank, and the stations are up. They had a lot of delays, in part because of technology and supply chain problems, and then Hurricane Sandy damaged some of the infrastructure. So I think cyclists in New York have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and now they'll soon be able to get on their bikes and ride them.
Well, I guess this is the big news that you bring. It's not just that bicycles are sharing the road, but that we're sharing the bikes. And I have heard through the interview several suggestions on why you would want to share one rather than just own your own. You don't have to park it at home. You don't have to protect it all the time. But why are you thinking that bike sharing is the way to go rather than private bike ownership?
Well, it's not an either-or thing. I think they work well in concert. In fact, anecdotally, talking to a lot of people I know in Washington, D.C. who have signed up for our Capital Bike Share, most of us who are members also have our own bikes, but it's just a way to add extra flexibility to your commute. It may be pouring rain in the morning, so you may take the subway or a bus to your office. But then when the sun comes out in the afternoon, you want to be able to jump on a bike and get to your softball game or happy hour or to pick up your kid from daycare. And then you can jump on the bike and do that. And then maybe you pick up your kid, but you don't want to take your kid on the bike yet. So you jump back on a bus or the subway system. So it's just a way to have a much more flexible transit system. And that's what a lot of the bike share operators really consider themselves, their transit. So they can be just part of a network within a city. And then it really complements bike ownership. In fact, some of the bicycle retailers had been worried about what's going to happen. You open this program, how are we going to sell any bikes? But in several of the cities that have studied it, including Washington, D.C. and San Antonio, Texas, they actually found that sales of private bikes also increased after the introduction of a bike sharing system. I think in part because people tried it out. It was like a gateway drug or something. And they said, wow, this is a great way to get along. I need my own bike. Or people saw more cyclists on the road and decided, you know, they wanted to jump in and do it too. So it works really well with existing cyclists often sign up to give themselves more flexibility because your bike's not always with you when you need it. And then it gets new people into cycling as well.
Well, what are you doing with all this information and how can people find it?
On our website, earthpolicy.org, people can see our article about bike sharing around the world, complete with a big data set listing the countries and places you can find programs around the world. And that's what we have at earthpolicy.org. There's also a great resource done by Paul DeMayo and Russell Medin called the Bike Share blog and the Bike Share World Map. And I highly recommend that people check them out because there you can see on a Google map where there's bike sharing programs all around the world, not just existing ones, but where cities are exploring them. And if your city is not yet on the Bike Share World Map, I would recommend that people who are excited about it contact their local officials and see what's being done, because I've talked to city planners in a number of cities and almost every single one is starting to look at this. And so I think they need to hear more enthusiasm that there really is an interest in bike sharing, because it's worked for large cities like Paris, but it's also working in tiny ones like Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places, was the first modern solar-powered bike-sharing program in the United States in a tiny town, so it can work on all sorts of scales.
Our guest has been Janet Larson, the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. This bicycle update is part of a series on the positive news coming from the Institute, and it covers everything from clean energy to maybe climate-friendly diet plans. And it's called Plan B, as advanced by the Institute's founder, Lester Brown. Track it down at earthpolicy.org. Janet, I appreciate so much good news for a change.
It's great to talk about bicycling.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find links for this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Please support Radio EcoShock if you can at our website, ecoshock.org, and grab lots of our free MP3 downloads of past programs. Are we out of time? Find out next week as I look into human extinction.